Hi, I'm Carrie. I'm an alcoholic. I want to start off by thanking you for allowing me to participate in your weekend. I want to thank Mike for inviting me. I'm sure he lobbied. And I'm really grateful to be a part of this. You know, of course, Gary, you know, in terms of, you know, no pressure here, gave me a list of the alumni of this weekend. And I kind of checked off and said, okay, hero, 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 grand sponsor, hero. And I'm going, oh, God, this is great, you know. A foul-mouthed brat from New Jersey is sitting here in this seat talking to you all about the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and God. And I'm thinking, like, the world is a really strange place. And God has an incredible sense of humor. Because somebody like me doesn't get to do something like this. Somebody like me, you know, gets thrown out of places like this. And in fact, I have tried on multiple occasions to vote me out of Alcoholics Anonymous in certain areas. I am banned from certain women's meetings in my area. I told that little story. And not because I'm me, you know, and I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in good standing, and I'm very grateful to say that. But what I would like to do before we start on this thing is maybe start with a prayer. I think it's really important for us to invite God into this weekend because, quite frankly, if God's not here, this weekend's going to suck for you, and it's going to suck for me because when we're not here in the fellowship of the Spirit, we're here with our sickness. And I have a progressive spiritual illness that shows up when I don't want it to. And so I need to acknowledge the power of God. And that power of God exists inside of all of us. It's not that it goes away. It's not that God disappears or we get unhooked. It's that I fall asleep to the fact that God dwells within me. So I want to take a minute, if we can, to just get quiet, to get into that center, to get into that place where that divine exists in each one of us. God, please help us to set aside everything we think we know about ourselves, the 12 steps, the program, and in spiritual terms, especially you, God. Please open our hearts and our minds so that we can see the truth about ourselves and move closer to you. Amen. And it's always good to start with the set aside prayer. I was in denial about this weekend. I did not.
If you could speak a little slower, I'm old, Indian boy.
People have been telling me to speak slower for 39 years. I will try. I'm a motor mouth from New Jersey, but I will attempt to speak slower.
Thank you.
I try not to think about what I was going to talk about this weekend because when I plan, usually I screw it up. So I thought about and said, probably the thing that's most salient to start off with is to tell you a little bit about who I am and how I got here. My sobriety date is September 6, 1994. My home group is a Way Out Big Book study in Tannersville, Pennsylvania, where there are bears. and I have a typical alcoholic story. You know, I am one of five kids. My parents are not alcoholics. Their parents are. I grew up, out of five of us, four of us have darkened the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am the only one who has remained. My brother found spirituality through church. My other brother smokes crack on a regular basis. And my sister, let's just say that CBS is her favorite place to go. So I grew up with alcoholism, with ism, all through my life. In fact, when it says in the big book that our alcoholic seems like life seems like the only normal one, you know, that was really true for me. And I used that for a long time to justify and rationalize my behavior, to explain why I was constitutionally incapable, and to mostly just blame other people for my choices and my decisions and my alcoholism. With that being said, I got here when I was 13 years old. I have been in Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I'm 39. I just turned 39. So I've been here a really long time. And I just celebrated 20 years in September. I spent 5 years dying in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and I wanted to make sure that I talked a little bit about that, because I talk fast and I froth at the mouth a little bit. I am very passionate about Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm very passionate about the 12 steps. I'm very passionate about the grace of God. And there are times when I can be a little too passionate, if you can be a little too passionate, and offensive. I'm going to be offensive. And it's not out of malice. It's sometimes I get really frustrated when I look at what Alcoholics Anonymous has become. And sometimes I want to weep for joy when I look at what Alcoholics Anonymous has become. I got sober in an area where people did not own big books. And if they did, they were coasters, or they read the stories in the back of the book. I got sober in a place where people talked about, well, if I made amends, this is what would happen. I got sober in a place where people were at a four-step, and that four-step was based on what other people did to them and why it was okay. And this is if they wrote it. And most of the time it was a four-step they wrote in their head, which I don't know how you can do that, but apparently there's some magical way that you can write a four-step in your head and somehow come to some truth with this and then go to a meeting and do a fifth step from the podium. You know, where I got sober, people used to say, I did a fifth step. I do a fifth step every time I come here. And I'm thinking, that's why I want you to shut up every time you open your mouth. So I'm a little fiery. I'm a little Irish. Just a little Irish. So I can be enthusiastic. If I offend you in any way, I apologize. I have been asking God. I have a Jersey mouth. I have asked God for many, 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 many years to help me clean up my language. He is doing it slowly but surely. You will hear a four-letter word, but it will be few and far between. God willing, you won't at all. But if I don't, what I'll do is I'll spend the whole time telling myself not to say the F word. I'll say it all the time. Because if you don't think the word penguin. Now you're all thinking about penguins, right? So if I spend this entire time saying, don't say that word, it's going to come out of my mouth. So if I come out, I apologize. You know, it's, I sometimes just have a filthy mouth, but I'm working on it. God's definitely removing this from me. Because that was one of the things I held on to. You know, it was like that, I'm still a street kid, you can't tame me. You know, I'm 39 years old with, you know, higher education degrees and very good career and all this stuff, but it's like, you know, but I still see myself as being that, you know, 15, 16 year old brat eating out of garbage cans and, you know, giving the finger to cops. You know, that is so, you know, for me, that was something that went, that really died hard. And I think part of it was coming into Alcoholics Anonymous so early and at such a young age, being the youngest person in the room, being the one where people were like, Al-Anon's down, or Alateen's down the hall. And I was like, I'm not here for Alateen. I'm here for AA. And then I'd get the old guy saying, I drank, you know, I spilled more beer than you drank. And I would say, dude, obviously you're not doing it right. I spill nothing. And if I do, I lick it up off the floor. You know, I had this one guy used to call me a kindergarten crackhead. I love that. He's like, oh, here comes the kindergarten crackheads. You know, so that whole, like, you know, rebel without a clue thing, that identity, that attachment, it's definitely going. You know, I'm definitely a lady today. Just every once in a while, that rebel, that identity pops out now and again. So if she does, I apologize. Just give me a smack in the back of the head, and I will go back to being God's carry instead of being a brat. So, been in AA since I was 13. I've also died in Alcoholics Anonymous 3 times. One of which I was actually dead for over two minutes. I have tried to kill myself while being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous 6 times. I have been on the flight deck while being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous 4 times. I have been in 9 rehabs. I have been in 4-point restraints. I have been in padded rooms while being a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So when we talk about my enthusiasm and sometimes my, what I like to call big book ninja-ism, it's because I've seen the best of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you all sitting here are the best of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I have seen the worst of Alcoholics Anonymous. And today, I like to participate in what I believe is the rebirth of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I was talking to Gary, and I said, you know, well, first of all, he walked up on me, and I said, oh, dear God. Or I said, oh, my God, because I thought he was, I expected him to be really old. Like, I really expected, like, this decrepit old man to wander up on me, right? And so he walks up all spry, and I was like, you're not old. That honesty thing's not, sometimes it's not always the best. And so he's like, I'm not God, I'm Gary. And we were chit-chatting, you know, and... So I was talking and I said, you know, I came out here and I was telling Mike, I have a list of questions which I will, at some point this weekend, buttonhole one of them. I'm expecting it'll probably be tomorrow during the free time, of questions that people from my neck of the woods would like to ask some of these guys. Now, so I'm all envious of you guys because you all got to be a part of this and a part of this specific conference or weekend from day one. You got to hear some of my heroes, some of the people that I have, you know, some of the people who have changed me on a very fundamental level. And they got to be a part of your recovery. They got to be a part of my recovery. I was very lucky where I got sober, you know, eventually, where I wandered, where I wound up. But on the other hand, you know, that generation of people who have that wisdom, they're diminishing and they're passing from this earth, and God bless them, they are. So we, the people in this room, we're responsible for keeping that wisdom, that enthusiasm, that spirit alive and furthering it. You know, we stop and say, okay, well, you know, I got all I need. I don't need to learn anything more. And we're doing a disservice to Alcoholics Anonymous, aren't we? So our job is to show up and be on the firing line of life, to carry this message, to be an example, to be the best version of the big book that anybody will ever read. You know, so we're all a part of this. And I have seen Alcoholics Anonymous change in the past 20 years. You know, I told you, I got sober in a place where people didn't own big books, where when I asked my sponsor about a higher power, she gave me a rock, which in a drunken binge, I think I left it at my parents' house, and then my mom threw it away. So my mom threw away my higher power. You know, if your higher power is a coffee cup, I'm going to pee in it. Because I'm going to prove to you that a higher power has to be a higher power by which you can live, and it has to be a power greater than yourself. And quite frankly, if I could void my bowels in your higher power, you need to get a new one. I mean, I'm being cheeky, but on the other hand, let's think about that for a minute. You know, so when I got sober, people handed me inanimate objects and told me to turn my will and my life over to the care of this inanimate object. And, you know, I'm dying. I'm dead. I'm trying to kill myself every 5 minutes, you know. I'm in and out of flight decks. I'm 90 pounds. I'm completely malnourished, filthy, disgusting, and lost. And you give me a rock and tell me it's going to fix my life? So that, you know, I've seen Alcoholics Anonymous be that. And I've seen Alcoholics Anonymous change to the point where somebody like me is invited to roundups and conferences. They don't even realize that I'm a big book speaker. I just talk about God and they want to hear it. And think about that for a minute. I was a headline speaker at Icky Pop. Now, that's wicked cool in its own self, but Icky Pop invited a big book thumper, a rabid, foaming at the mouth big book thumper, to be their Friday night speaker. Alcoholics Anonymous has changed. Because that would never have happened 20 years ago. We went to Icky Pot to fornicate, mostly. I mean, I cleaned it up, but that's what we're taking. It would be like, who came back from Icky Pot, what STD, you know. You know, and mind you, you know, a couple years ago, I'm their Friday night speaker. That is a tremendous change in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's because the people sitting in this room, and because you all are here. and because we leave here and we do what we do. So I want to thank you. So, I'm an alcoholic. I drink. When I drink, I can't control how much I drink. When I'm not drinking, I don't like nothing. I'm irritable, restless, and discontent. I qualify for being an alcoholic. Do you know how long I had been in Alcoholics Anonymous before I was actually qualified to be an alcoholic? I was 20 years old. I had been in Alcoholics Anonymous 7 years. And it was actually a guy from California who did it. You know? For me, the most salient thing or the most important thing that I need to do as an alcoholic, a recovered alcoholic, meaning I'm recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body, is to broaden and deepen my experience with higher power. You know, I'm going to talk about the steps and the way that I'm going to talk about them and what we're going to do here. And I'm going to talk about it at multiple levels. Now, I said that I was a very lucky woman and I'm a very blessed woman. I have had some of the best sponsors in the world. I have had some of the best guidance in the world. I've had the opportunity to go through the steps many, 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 many different ways and many different formulations. And that in itself is incredibly awesome, you know, because somebody pointed something out to me a long time ago, and it actually says it in our book. It talks about it in We Agnostics. It talks about having an open mind, right? It says, you know, that we're willing in human concerns with technology, you know, to have an open mind and try a new gadget, a new idea. But, you know, when it comes to spiritual stuff, we're like, no. No new information, right? But think about this. Is how many times did you drink a beer that had a cigarette in it? How many times did you pull a cigarette butt out of a beer, nobody saw that, and drink it? How many times did you consider whether or not you would be able to get the entire bottle of scope down your throat before you threw it up? And whether your bottle would be green or blue, right? You know, we're not discriminating when it comes to our drinking, are we? And that's kind of what I'm pointing out here. I was that kind of alcoholic. I was not a high-class wine-drinking alcoholic. I was a drink the dregs of the bottle, whatever I can get, whatever I cannot be here right now. I need alcohol in my body because more than anything else, I do not want to be carried. And the only thing that made me not carry was putting the alcohol in my body. Now, I was not discriminating by any way, shape, or form. I have drank dry vermouth. I have drank creme de menthe from the little, you know, little tiny ball that you get for Christmas. My mother had a stash of them. I found them. It's not pleasant when you throw that up, by the way. Not at all. I have funneled Everclear. But you give me a new version of the fourth step, and I'm going, or like change the columns a little bit. Change around the questions, or ask me to consider something, or ask me to do this specific prayer, or ask me to do this spiritual exercise, and I say, no. I do not want the effect produced by that. So, what was challenged to me, and that why we started with the set aside prayer, was for me to be as open-minded on spiritual matters as I am on other things. And when I, at times, balked on certain things, my sponsor would tell me to put a bottle next to my big book and ask myself, which is easier, die an alcoholic death or live on a spiritual basis? Now, that's an intellectual concept, right? I mean, I could say, die an alcoholic death or live on a spiritual basis. Put that bottle next to your book. Like, literally, buy an air-clean bottle of alcohol, put it next to your big book, and feel the power that that alcohol has over you when you are in this state of illness, when you are blocked off from God. I had a sponsee do that once. She said that she felt like it followed her around the house, that she'd be up. She had it on her kitchen table, and she was balking on amends, put the airplane bottle of Jack Daniels next to her big book. She said she felt it pulsate from the table up through the ceiling, through the floor of her bedroom, and into her bed. She felt it, that power of alcohol. You know, she also made the amends within 24 hours of putting that bottle on her table. Because sometimes having that palatable experience, that pull, because when I'm in that self-will, when I'm in that spot, you know, when I'm removed, I think I'm fine. But when I'm looking it dead in the eye, we're powerless. And it doesn't mean that I'm hopeless, and it doesn't mean I can't get access to power. But I don't know when I'm locked off. I don't. I can fall asleep dreaming I'm awake any given moment of the day. You know, I go on autopilot, and all of a sudden I'm blocked off from God. And I don't see it, because I still think I'm fine. Until I get that thing in the pit of my gut, or somebody says, Carrie, what's wrong with you? You look like you're off. What's up with you? And I got to stop and go, yeah, what is? You know, there's an old Oxford group saying the light of God shines better through two light than two windows than one. Meaning that you all are my spiritual mirror. The people in my life are my spiritual mirrors. My children are my spiritual mirror. My husband's my spiritual mirror. That they reflect back to me what's truly going on inside of me. You know. So there are times when I can fall asleep. We're all capable of doing it. It's the grace of God that allows us to wake back up. So what I'd really like for us to do is to have this experience together. I want to know, what is it that you really want to work on? What is it that you really want to look at? Where are we stuck as a community, as a group? So if there's something or some aspect of this process as we're going through it that you really want to know about, raise your hand. Shout something out. You know, pull me aside. And we'll do this as we'll allow the light of God to shine through all of us, so we can all be illuminated right here, right now, and walk out of here with elevated spirits and a sense of wholeness. You know, so that's a little bit about me. It's a little bit about my experience. When I think about, or when we talk about the first step, I'm going to talk about it from the newcomer perspective of what being an alcoholic really means. And then we're going to talk about it from the falling asleep, dreaming I'm awake perspective. Meaning, like, where are my agnosticisms? Where is my unmanageability? Where is that showing up? So, because the thing is like, you know, I could think I have it all managed. And then all of a sudden I wake up and I realize that I called Mike a couple, like it was about a year ago, losing my stuff about my job, maybe like 9 months ago, 10 months ago, something like that. Losing my stuff about my job. And I'm like, I can't get rah, and I'm going on, and he's so patient. You know, he didn't listen, you know, and I'm ranting. And then he stops and he gives me one simple suggestion that has absolutely changed my life. Something so simple, so reasonable and logical, but when I'm in it, I can't see it. So we all have areas in our life that are like that. There's no perfect person here. That is not what it means to be recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body. And I think for a long time, I thought that was the case. I thought that in order to be that, or to be a speaker, to sit in this chair, you have to be perfect. And I think that's a delusion. You know, because I have yet to meet a perfect person. Sorry, Gary. What I have met is people who have a little bit more experience than myself. But we all have something to share. We all have something to bring to this table. So I told you I died in Alcoholics Anonymous. I told you that Alcoholics Anonymous that I grew up in was an Alcoholics Anonymous that was not Alcoholics Anonymous. It was therapy. It was rehab stuff. It was watered down. I use that phrase. I love a friend who calls it... He said that it is, well, there's two words he uses, dark, or two phrases, dark tunnel and oral tradition Alcoholics Anonymous. What I look at it is this, is, you know, again, how do you know what you don't know? There's a bunch of people who were trying to recover from an illness without any instructions. Now, mind you, if you want to hide anything from an alcoholic, just put it in the big book. We ain't reading that. It's hard. Bill was a terrible writer. Sorry, he was. He did not ever hear of a semicolon. You ever read? Like, there's sentences in the big book that last three paragraphs, and you're thinking, Bill, you really, like, have you ever heard of a period? A comma. A semicolon. Have you ever heard of a conditional clause? Bill was a product of his time. Bill was a townie who grew up looking at the rich kids, who wanted to be one of them, wanted to sound like one of them, you know? And so when he wrote this book, he wanted us to think that he was a Rockefeller. Unfortunately, Rockefellers know how to use commas and don't say things like boiled as an owl. I looked that up, by the way. It means drunk, but still, you know, like, Bill used some antiquated language. So when I first was introduced to this book and I read it, one, I said, well, if you can't write a book that is grammatically correct, with my ninth grade education, by the way, then I will not read it. I will not read AA literature until it appears the way it should. That's part of the reason why I died while being in that book. I think that there was a sense of snobbery. And what's really weird is, you know, I grew up in Montclair, New Jersey. Do you know one of the first real Alcoholics Anonymous meetings was in Montclair, New Jersey? Do you know that the book and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was named in a meeting in Montclair, New Jersey? The big book was written a mile and a half from where I grew up. Do you know how gosh darn sad that is? But I grew up in an area where the big book was written, yet we didn't read it, look at it, nor touch it if we could. Think about that. That's really gosh darn sad, isn't it? The founder, co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, had an office a mile and a half from my house where I grew up. Yet, we didn't read the big book. We didn't need it because we had Prozac. Rehabs. And I'm not here to trash those things. I mean, I'll out myself right now. I'm a therapist. You know? Like, I don't have a problem with that. But I'm not here as a therapist. I'm here as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I out myself because every once in a while I code switch and someone's like, ooh, she just used a therapeutic term. And I'm like, oh, I forgot. I'm not running group. I'm in AA. But, you know, we really lost our way in my area, you know. And when you kind of think about that and say that the big book was born where I grew up, where I got sober. And one of my first meetings was one of the first meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Mm. After, you know, Clarence, you know, and his resentment in his coffee pot, you know, I guess it was meeting number two. And yet, the AA in my area was not Alcoholics Anonymous. Because the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous were two very different things. You know, this is fellowship. We're not, all of us sitting in this room, this is fellowship. I'm practicing my 12th step because I'm carrying a message. You're listening. So you're practicing your 12th step. You're also practicing your first step. I'm talking about my experience with alcohol, so I'm also practicing my first step. When we walk out of here and I put my hand out to you and you ask me a question or I ask you a question, we're practicing some steps. But in general, I think a lot of times we missed, or I missed, or I was taught that the program was just showing up. It was 90 dances in 90 days. I dated every guy in my home group. I was pretty sure if I slept my way through my home group, I would figure out how to stay sober. I made a lot of coffee. I lied a lot too, because here's the thing, it's like, I'm not going to come here and tell you the truth about myself, because then you would actually know me, so I had to make stuff up in order to, but don't you know, the person in the meeting who has the biggest problem is the winner today, right? Because the idea is, if I present this terrible problem, yet I'm this long-suffering spiritual person who still keeps coming back, because meeting makers make it, right? So I come and I present. It's a horrible atrocity that did not happen to me, that I probably saw on daytime TV or Beverly Hills 90210, and I spewed it on the table, and then everybody goes around the room and tells me about how strong I am, because you know what? Just don't drink. Meeting makers make it. Let go and let God. How do you let go and let God, guys? Like, seriously, we say this stuff. By the way, those are slogans. They only make sense if you actually work the steps, and we rip them off from Al-Anon. They are found in the Al-Anon chapters of the book. Did you ever notice that? Like, you know why, like, you know, up until To the Wives and Family afterward, there are no slogans, and then To the Wives and Family afterward, they start popping off the slogans, because those are slogans given to the people who have to deal with us one day at a time. This tells me, you know, die an alcoholic death or live on a spiritual basis. Nowhere does it tell me, oh, you poor thing, just one day at a time. So those are Al-Anon slogans. Love Al-Anon, rip it off all the time, go to Al-Anon, big proponent of Al-Anon. Don't apply to me when I'm sitting in this chair. You know. So, the person with the coolest story, right, gets to be the winner today. And then, of course, and then this one I love, which is whoever woke up earliest in the morning is a winner. So I would lie. I slept to noon, but I would tell you I was up at 6 o'clock in the morning in this work. I was the most sober. I would lie about how early I woke up so that I could feel more important, so I could feel special. You know, and you work these steps and you find out you're a child of God. And there's no need to rationalize, justify, or even crow about who I am, because it comes from within. And all of a sudden, all of those things that I used to do just said seemed so crazy. And I would think, and now I look back and I see myself in, like, the newcomers who come to the meetings, and I just laugh, you know, like the ones who raise their hand and they just spit out, and they're like the one with 30 days who's going to tell the guy with 16 years whose wife just died what he needs to do in order for him to stay sober. And I'm thinking, like, that's so cute. You know, but this is the Alcoholics Anonymous I got sober in. So, me being a hopeless alcoholic, me being somebody who puts alcohol in my body despite the negative consequences, me being somebody who once I start drinking I can't stop, me being somebody who would walk into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and drink in the bathroom because I couldn't be here and have you see me or interact with you without alcohol in my body. I was the person who would say that I would not drink before I went to a meeting and would be drunk before I got there. Because lack of power is my dilemma, man. And if lack of power, the inability to make what I know in my mind is right, manifest in my actions. That's the lack of power that we're talking about. Now, we have that lack of power. If you're an alcoholic, you have that lack of power in terms of alcohol. If you're an alcoholic of the hopeless variety, you have that lack of power in terms of alcohol, so that lack of power in terms of your morals, in terms of your philosophical convictions. So what our job, what the spiritual awakening is all about, is about reconnecting my head to my heart and making it so that the things that I know to be right can actually come out and be translated into my actions on a daily basis. So I was 2 years sober when I was introduced to the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I wish I had from the second I hit the door, you know, had this experience. I wish I didn't have to die an alcoholic death for 2 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wish I didn't have to suffer that. And I wish that nobody ever has to suffer not being able to drink and not being able to live. Because that is a terrible place to be. So I was 2 years sober. I met my husband in Alcoholics Anonymous. He was coming off a bender. I was abusing an outside issue, celebrating clean time. Because at a certain point I just gave up. I just said, you know what, I won't drink, but I'll do all the other stuff. And this is AA, so I'll just celebrate. So he was coming off a bender. I was 17, he was 25. What he had said to me when he met me, first of all, I sat down next to him, my sponsor pulled me away by my ear. I fired her. She was a good lady too. Two things he said to me that made me say, you know, this man's a keeper. First of all, he said, I just got off parole. And then he said, my husband, he's from Northern California. They're weird up there.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he said, you know what? I really like you, Carrie, but I ate 3 sheets of acid one night, and I'm not really sure, like, even if I'm in New Jersey, I could be in a mental asylum in Northern California. But if you are not a hallucination and I'm not still tripping, I'd really like that. And I was like, this is a keeper, man. I'm taking some home. Now, mind you, my family, my parents are wonderful human beings. They really are. My mother's a Eucharistic minister. My dad is an usher in the church. I was raised in a very strict, very religious household. So naturally, I became a devil worshiper. You know, no, I didn't. But but I think my mom at certain points probably thought I did. Like when I started coming home with the, you know, the spiked hair and the stuff in my face and the tattoos. And, you know, I'm pretty sure she was, you know, looking for 666 somewhere on me. So my parents were have a lot of values. They were very religious, very lovely human beings. They do not drink alcoholically. They're just people. They just happen to give birth to 4 Satan spawn. And my sister Maureen, who is not an alcoholic, she's an Al-Anon. She's a raging Al-Anon. She's the one who says, Carrie, can you detox my son off of heroin and then I'll just give him money, you know, just every other day. You know. And I have dragged her to Al-Anon. I've actually tricked her once. I was doing a conference in Windsor, Ontario. I told her it was at this like palatial, like resort. I was like, it's beautiful. It really was awesome, but it was not. And I dragged her there, told her that we were going to go gambling and stuff, and instead I made her sit in Al-Anon meetings. She was not happy. The 12-hour car ride home told me so. but she, you know, so she says things like, you know, like, I'm feeling this one. You know, or, you know, I went on a cruise with my 2 sisters, and my sister Maureen, like, had this bottle of wine that she smuggled. Yeah, because we're still criminals. I mean, like, just because she's not an alcoholic doesn't mean that she's not shady, you know. You know, like, she's not paying duties on this stuff. So, like, somehow she, I don't know where she put the wine. I don't really want to ask. I certainly didn't want to touch the bottle when it was sitting there. Not because it's wine, because I wouldn't know where it was. So somehow she managed to get this wine on the ship. And it was sitting on the bedside table. Now I'm a recovered alcoholic, you know, and that wine was like, it was like having bleach. It was inert to me. It was certainly not something I wanted to put in my body. And so she's sitting there and she goes, you know, I see it like not moving. Like the cork is in it, you know, like I see her not drinking it, and I'm thinking, you went through all that trouble putting wine in places where wine should never be, so you didn't have to pay for it or pay the tax on it to just let it sit there? It just seemed completely ridiculous. And I asked her about it, and she's like, well, I only want it when I want to unwind every once in a while. I don't want it. And I thought, how are you related to me? I mean, I was just at my uncle's 80th birthday party and my brother stole $20 out of my purse to buy crack. That I can understand. You know, but the sister who let wine sit on the table because she couldn't be bothered to drink it? Who cares if you can... I mean, like, seriously, inject it. I don't know, do something to it. Just don't leave it there. It seems abusive. I'm like, you know, I don't get her. And she doesn't get me. Did you know wine goes bad? She told me that. Apparently it turns into vinegar. I didn't know that. I mean, frankly, I think the wine I drank probably was vinegar. I mean, I don't think Boone's Farm, I think that was pretty close to being vinegar or something. But, like, so my sister has a very different relationship with alcohol than I do, you know? So in my family, with my parents, they have a very similar relationship to my sister. So they really didn't get me at all. I mean, I'm pretty sure my parents did an exorcism I'm sure they did. I'm absolutely sure that at some point I was passed out in bed and my mom dragged the local priest in there to try and get the demons out of me because she could not understand why her beautiful, sweet daughter would do the horrible things that I do or that I did. Today she knows that I'm an alcoholic, you know, and today I've made amends for those things. And today she's actually with my children right now at my son's concert while I'm here and tells you a little bit about how Alcoholics Anonymous rebuilds families. But I'm an alcoholic of the hopeless variety, you know. So I have a mind that obsesses on it. I have a body that craves it. The craving is in the body, not in the mind. You know, a lot of times we hear that. And it always drives me crazy when people say, I'm craving alcohol. And it's like, when was the last time you drank? 6 months ago. I'm like, you're not craving. You're falling, you know, you have the mental obsession. You have alcoholic thinking. Now, we can diagnose alcoholic thinking, man. That's when we know that we've fallen asleep dreaming that we're awake, right? When we got that alcoholic thinking. Now, if you're clean or sober for a period of time, your alcoholic thinking isn't going to be about alcohol. It's going to be about them. Or her. Or him. Or it. You know, because alcohol doesn't come to us in bottles anymore. It comes to us in the back door. You know, we have to do some work in order to disengage ourselves from the spiritual practices that we have in order for us to put alcohol back in our body. You know, so for us, it comes to us in human form. And it comes to us in human powers. And then it comes to us in the bottle. So alcoholic thinking can be a lot of different things, and I really want to talk about that this weekend. I want us to really see, like, where is that showing up in my life? And it is, and it will, because you're an alcoholic. You know, if you're sitting here and you're an alcoholic, alcoholic thinking is going to show up. But I have a higher power, and I love that it tells me that God doesn't make too hard terms with those who seek him. I thought the first time I made a mistake in Alcoholics Anonymous, the first time I fell off the beam, the first time I had, you know, in the 10th step, Bill doesn't say, watch for if selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. He says, watch for when. Because he's assuming it's going to happen. But I thought the first time I was incredibly selfish and dishonest, I was going to burst into flames. The fact is, I was incredibly selfish and dishonest all the time. I was just delusional about it. And the first time I had that moment where I was, like, wrong. You know when you call your sponsor and your sponsor's like, you know what, you need to get a pen and paper. And I'm like, oh, no. Right? The first time that happens and your sponsor's like, we're meeting for coffee because we got something to talk about and this is real. We're going to sit down. We're going to four column. Then we're going to take this. We're going to take it down to the bone. Right? And the first time you have that moment and you realize, oh, my God, by all intents and purposes, I'm resting on my laurels. I could be drunk right now, but I'm not. Why? It's because God is loving and God is kind. We judge ourselves by our intention. Other people judge us by our actions. God judges us by all. Meaning that when I truly endeavor to live on a spiritual basis, I am safe and protected. Because I'm going to be truly endeavoring to live on a spiritual basis and still be a bonehead. That my higher power, my belief is that God loves me. God wants me to be happy, joyous, and free. And the only thing that prevents me from being happy, joyous, and free is, frankly, me. And the limits I set on God's power. So, I was taught that there was this wonderful, beautiful God in my life. I was taught that as a child. I didn't hear that. What I heard is you're bad. What I heard is you're broken. What I heard is there's something wrong with you. I don't know why I internalized that message. But I know that a lot of alcoholics do. And I think that I would like to think that that's probably the spiritual malady that shows up for us. That I like have a broken filter. That you could be saying, Carrie, you're a wonderful human being. And what I'm hearing is, Carrie, you're a wonderful human being, but you should be better. You know? For whatever reason, my alcoholism shows up with this broken filter. Now, if you have a broken filter and you're crazy as a shithouse rat, drinking seems like a really good idea, doesn't it? So, for a long time, I thought I drank because I wanted to. I didn't realize that I drank because I needed to. And when we talk about this and we're talking about the unmanageabilities, we're talking about human power, when we're talking about alcoholic thinking, when we're talking about agnosticisms, when we're talking about how this shows up in our life, and we say, you know, why is it that somebody who has no alcohol in their body will pick up a drink. It is the craziest, most insane thing that we'll do, knowing what the consequences are, yet we still do it. There are two reasons why people relapse. One is they convince themselves that they have power over alcohol, or that this time it is different, right? They forget. You only do that a few dozen times and you don't forget anymore, right? I mean, the first handful of times you pick up a drink after like a terrible thing happens, right? So you get drunk, you trash something, you break up with your boyfriend, you pee in their bed, whatever it is that you did. Okay. Not that any of you guys were like me at all. Okay. I'm sure you're all gentlemen and ladies, but I was not. So you do something like that. And the next week you say, I'm not going to drink like that again. Yet the next weekend comes around, you say, well, it was the Cuervo. I just drink beer. Right? And then you throw up everywhere, you pee on yourself, and then you say, well, it was the beer. Rum. That's the ticket. And whenever, after you rearrange the deck chairs in the Titanic a few times, right, you know it's not the rum. You know it's not the Cuervo. You know it's you, right? Yet we do it again. Why? Because we're driven. Because we have a need. Because deep down inside of me, I'm irritable, restless, and discontent. I can't see life with alcohol. I can't see life without it. And more than anything else, what I need to do is I need to shut up the thousands squawking monkeys in my head. And the only way that Carrie knows how to do that, there are two ways. God and booze. Now, I take some work. I want to do that. I'm all about the instant gratification. Booze is simple and easy. The problem is that all it does is throw gasoline on a fire, right? So the more I throw gasoline on the fire, the more the fire burns, the more prices I pay, the more I do it. Talks about it in the fifth step. It talks about, right, that we have a person that we want people to believe that we are. We shudder when we think about how if you really saw me in my darkest moments, that you would know that I was not that person I'm pretending to be, right? And that we push it deep down inside, and that constant conflict between who I want you to think I am and who I really am causes me to need to anesthetize those feelings. So when I am abstinent from alcohol and I put it in my body, yes, I'm insane, but I'm hijacked. I'm hijacked by a need to quiet that spiritual illness, which is why our book tells us we need to straighten out spiritually and then we straighten out mentally and physically. Because I can withdraw, I can detox, I can drink my carrot juice, I can go to the gym, I can do all of those things, I can go to therapy, I can talk about my inner child, I can spank my inner child. It doesn't change that I have a progressive spiritual illness, and it doesn't change that spiritual malady. And it's that spiritual malady that is the engine of my disease. And it is the thing that causes the condition that makes alcohol look like a good idea. So for us, for me, as an alcoholic, I drink for relief. I drink to quiet that spiritual malady. So when we talk about what we're going to talk about a lot this weekend is how we do that and how we go deeper. It looks like everybody's getting a little restless, so I think we're about ready for a break, but I kind of want to, and I know you guys have heard this 1,000 times, because I think the guy who coined it was 2000, okay. When we talk about it, and I had one of my spiritual teachers told me and said, you know, when you go to an ocean with a thimble, you get a thimble full of ocean, right? And we go with a bucket, we get a bucket full of ocean. You know, that every time I go to the ocean, I'm only limited by what I think the ocean could offer me. So when we talk about this infinite spiritual love, when we talk about this recovery process, when we talk about this oneness, this communion with God, and when I say God, I mean good orderly direction, sure ain't me, higher power, but X, as in like, you know, X, whatever you want it to be. As long as it's not a coffee cup or a bedpan, we're good. Power greater than yourself. You know. But when we talk about this, and when we're talking about this process, and we're talking about going deeper, I want you to realize that when we go deeper, and we do, we need to. And when we do, we're going to see things that we don't like about ourselves, and that's okay. You know, recovering from alcoholism requires us to look at some icky, icky things. And it also I thought that being spiritual and the spiritual thing was about addition. Let me add spiritual practices to my life. Most of the time, this spirituality is about subtraction. It's about, what am I willing to pay up to be free? What am I willing to let go of? What belief systems do I have about you or me that are preventing me from being truly useful and happy in my life? I have to be uncomfortable in order to get free. That there's a price for this comfort. And I think a lot of times we get so caught in the good that we stop seeking the best and true freedom. So we get comfortable and complacent in a level of spirituality and say, okay, I'm good here. But I guess my question and the thing I want to challenge you guys most with this weekend is, yeah, here's good. Great. You're awesome. But what could you be? What does God want you to be? You know, I started this talking about what Alcoholics Anonymous was when I got sober. I talked to you about my years in Alcoholics Anonymous, dying literally and figuratively. And I said that Alcoholics Anonymous, the Alcoholics Anonymous that I walked into, is not the Alcoholics Anonymous that is here today. If each one of us said, you know, this is too much work trying to change Alcoholics Anonymous, because we're so arrogant we thought we could, you know, but, you know, bleeding deacon was not a term we heard before. But that's in the 12 and 12. Those of you, you know, that's a great book. but, you know, the idea is that we were arrogant enough to believe that we could change Alcoholics Anonymous. And we did. You did. Alcoholics Anonymous has changed because people believed in God in the 12 steps enough to do that. So if that can happen in this one little place, what could the power of God do for you? What could the power of looking at some things that might make you uncomfortable, facing some things you may not like about yourself, what could that do for you? Could it set you free on a level that you could never have anticipated nor quantify before? It's quite possible. Or nothing could happen. And you stay right where you are. So you see something you don't like about yourself and you're happy and complacent in your life and things are great. Nothing happens. Okay. It didn't cost you anything. You know? And so the idea here is that if we go deeper and we go further and we challenge ourselves and we really look, and we abandon those fears of, if I look at myself and I don't like who I am, then I'll be nothing, or I'm worthless, or I'm unworthy of love. If we abandon those fears and seek, we'll find. And our real, true beliefs of who we are and who God is will come to us. And I think that's really what we're here to do this weekend. I think that's what you've been doing for the past 10 years. And I feel privileged to be a part of it. So I think we can take a break and when you say 15 minutes? 15.